Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we are continuing our series on one of the most significant movements in film history, the French New Wave. Today we turn our discussion towards the idea of auteur theory and look at the film Jules and Jim from director François Truffaut. Cinephile and film podcaster Omaya Jones is back for this episode, so stick around. Really quick plug for our Patreon. If you love Art House Garage and want even more, you can subscribe to our Patreon today. In addition to supporting the show financially, you also get bonus episodes, uncut episodes, video episodes, and ad-free episodes. The most recent bonus episode that I actually just finished recording with Russell Miller is a little spoiler talk about Thor: Love and Thunder. So if you loved that movie or hated that movie and want to hear what we have to say, check out the Patreon for that coming very soon. We've also got merchandise discounts, video interviews, some great stuff there. So go to patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. Okay, back to the show.
Qui c'est, Jules?
C'est moi.
Et vous?
Jim.
Jim et Jules, alors?
Non, Jules et Jim.
Elle avait des bagues à chaque doigt, des tas de bracelets autour des poignets, et puis elle chantait avec une voix.
Attention, prêt. Un, voilà. Deux, oh.
Elle avait des yeux d'opale qui fascinaient, qui me fascinaient. Il y avait l'ovale de son visage pâle, de femme fatale qui me fut. Fatale, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale. Chacun pour soi est reparti dans le tourbillon de la vie. Je l'ai revu un soir, aïe aïe aïe.
Jules!
Jules!
Ça fait déjà un femme bail. Quand on s'est connu, quand on s'est reconnu, pourquoi se perdre de vue, se reperdre de vue? Quand on s'est retrouvé, quand on s'est réchauffé, pourquoi se séparer? Chacun pour soi est reparti dans le tourbillon de la vie. On a continué à tourner, tous les deux enlacés, tous les deux enlacés, tous les deux enlacés.
Welcome to Art House Garage. Before we get into today's discussion, a quick note. I said on the previous episode that this week's show would be about the new A24 film, Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. Well, that one doesn't actually come out in wide release till next week, so I decided to swap the two. So this week is part two of the French New Wave, and you can look forward next time for a discussion of Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. Okay, with that out of the way, let's get into today's discussion. Last time on the show, Omaya Jones helped us with a general overview of what the French New Wave is and why it's important, and we talked about the film Vivre sa vie from director Jean-Luc Godard. So if you haven't heard that yet, go back and check it out. Today, we're looking at another important director from this period. It's François Truffaut. We'll talk about his film, Jules and Jim, and we'll open by looking at one of the most important concepts that emerged from this time, auteur theory. If you aren't familiar with Omaya Jones, he's been on this show many times before. He also organizes and programs the Arkansas Times film series and is just generally involved in lots of film things in Central Arkansas. Omaya, welcome back to Art House Garage. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me again. I it's always nice to be here and talk films and cinema.
Yes. Well, I said last time on the show, you know, that you programmed the Arkansas Times film series. It was on hiatus. It has been on hiatus because of the pandemic. But I think that we're able to add film programmer back into your title, correct? Tell us what's going on there.
Right. So, yes, about a week ago, we reached out to Riverdale to see if there was interest in starting back up. And actually, I think when I was going to see something, I don't even remember what it was at this point, but the manager actually asked if we had planned on bringing it back. And so I met with Stephanie Smittle at the Arkansas Times and also Rhett Brinkley, who's there now, who does a lot of writing for them on culture and food stuff. And we reached out to Riverdale and got it started back up again. And so the first thing that we've got coming up will be hopefully, we're still sort of making sure all the T's are crossed and I's dotted or whatever. But actually, the 23rd of this month, Uncle Bumi, who can recall his past lives, which we talked about, I think last year. I think that was last year, right?
It might have been 2 years ago.
Okay.
I think I think that was also the first time you were ever on the show.
Oh. Because
cool, we did contemporary Asian cinema, and we started with two Weirdest Ethical Films, that one and Cemetery of Splendor.
Mm-hmm. So yes, which we screened as part of this series in 2019.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and the reason that we're doing Uncle Bunmi is because on the 26th, they start showing at Pichampong's newest film, Memoria. And so we wanted to do something that sort of coordinated with that screening so we can promote that, because I'm actually really excited about that coming.
Yes.
And then so to kick it off this year, we're going to do a film every other month.
Okay.
Before I think transitioning back to monthly in 2023. So then I'll tell you that the proposed films for the rest of the year is in October will be Raw.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oof, and I'm nervous to watch it again. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, so like, you know, I try to have a balance in the films in terms of, well, definitely in terms of like gender of the director and the creative team and everything. That's not the only reason I want to show Raw. I actually think it's really good. And I actually was really excited about Titane. And I just think it's a good excuse to like expose more people to this exciting director. Mm-hmm. And it's perfect for October because, you know, Halloween and everything.
Yeah.
And then in December, the proposed film is Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which is
I've never seen that.
Japanese film by Nagase Oshima, who also directed, I think, like, probably outside of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, his probably most known film is In the Realm of the Senses.
Mm, okay, yeah.
And it also stars David Bowie, Katsushi Kitano, and the composer was like, I can't pronounce his name. I have not committed his name to memory yet, but it actually has like one of the greatest scores of all time, to me anyway, right up there with the score for Jules and Jim, which we'll talk about, which I also think is there like one go. Of the best composed scores of all time.
Yeah, I did the really good. Wow, that's quite a lineup. That's really cool. That also the David Bowie tie-in, because we have the great great looking Bowie, and what I've heard so far is that it's really good, the Bowie sort of biopic that is called Moon Age Daydream coming in a few months too. So it'll be a little David.
Is that slated to be a December release? Like, is that coming out this calendar year?
I want
to
say it's September or November, I think, because I know it played. I got an email the other day that it's like in the works for pretty soon. I think it's going to be like this award season, and it's going to be like an IMAX release and all of that. So that's kind of cool too. But yeah, so I mean, first of all, about the Arkansas Times film series, I think it's so cool because, you know, you hear about, oh, in LA and in New York, you can go watch these old movies all the time, or you can watch these art house things that we just don't get here in Central Arkansas. So Arkansas Times film series, which you program, is, I think it's so huge to bring some of that here. And so I'm always excited. Like Uncle Bunmi, I loved, and I've never seen it on the big screen. And so I'm really excited to do that, or with a crowd. And then, of course, Memoria, if anyone doesn't know, that's his latest film. And the sort of strange distribution model they're doing is that supposedly they're not releasing it on home video. Although I think you can buy a British.
That's like, it's like, so like Neon, who's the North American distributor, has said that they will never release it on home video. So that's like a North America / US specific thing.
Yeah,
and okay. So it's just doing these 1 week engagements.
So it's like a tour. Sort of
touring. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, probably won't get it here in Little Rock. And then I found out it is coming on my birthday, no less, August 26th. So I'm so excited for that. And then now I can make it a Weirdest Ethical doubleheader that week with Uncle Bunmi before that. So that is just super exciting. I can't wait. And I encourage anyone listening to check that out. If you're anywhere nearby Central Arkansas, I'll link to the Facebook page event for that. And I think ticket information is coming soon.
Yes.
Cool. All right. Anything else we need to know about the screenings?
You know, I just want to encourage everybody to come out. You know, like I think, you know, the way it works is Riverdale pays for the rights to everything, like the rights to screen things. And I think it's good to support local businesses. So I just want people to come out. and just support the series, support Memoria when it's here, and just also, you know, support smaller independent films.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, I really thought Memoria, it'll probably come to like Dallas. I think you and I texted about it. Like, we'll make a road trip whenever it happens. And then we're like, oh, we're getting in a Little Rock. So very exciting stuff. Well, that is great. Lots to look forward to in a few weeks. And let's shift our focus now to the French New Wave, episode 2 of our series on the French New Wave. And let's talk about... I guess let's start by talking about auteur theory. So we talked last week about kind of an introduction to the French New Wave and how it's kind of this really creative period. All these, they were kind of film critics first and then got cameras and broke all the rules and just had this incredibly creative kind of period that has been hugely influential since then. And one of the ideas that has kind of come out of that is something, I think I learned this word before I ever heard about what the French New Wave is, and that is auteur theory. So what is auteur theory? What is that translated as, and why is that such an important thing?
I'm curious, sort of like, do you have a take on auteur theory?
Yeah.
I find it, as a concept, it can be kind of divisive, it seems.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I can tell you, so I learned... You know, I didn't study film in college, but I got to go to, I had one film class and we learned about it in that. And basically, you know, auteur, I believe, translates as author. And so it's kind of the idea that the director is the author or the creative force, the primary creative force behind a film, or should be, right? And kind of before this time, for the most part, the director, they were involved in creative decisions, but it wasn't like, they were the person, I mean, writer director was a less common thing, I think. They weren't necessarily like the creative person. Like the producers had the idea of like, here's how this is going to happen. We'll get actors, we'll get this star, we'll get this star, we'll get this person to do the music, we'll get this person to direct it. And it's like the director is just another part of this team, and they're the ones there on the day, yelling action, yelling cut, making those decisions, kind of being the leader on set. But this is sort of a shift in thinking to say, okay, like if we had a singular vision from a single person, then that makes film more interesting. And so one of the things that I learned as kind of researching for this is I found on Criterion's website, is Truffaut, and he wrote that that essay we talked about last time in Cahiers du Cinéma called A Certain Tendency of the French Cinema. And this is kind of where he introduced the idea, I believe. But in this short clip, it was like an interview he did on some American talk show. But he talked about, I don't think I'd had it heard it put this way, or at least I'd forgotten, that he kind of puts it, auteur theory versus working anonymously. So he talks about, in that essay as well, he talks about like people adapting, in, you know, literature, different things, and sort of like stepping out and letting, you know, whatever the story is kind of speak for itself, I guess, versus, you know, saying, okay, I'm Francois Truffaut. I have these ideas. I have the way I see the world, and I'm going to try to translate onto a camera. And that's just a very kind of different approach that I think still carries through. And now we have, okay, like a Tarantino movie is different than a Marvel movie or something, or a Scorsese movie. That's a lot of different ideas. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think I was trying to like check the producer of the film, but like, yeah, you're right. And something that you're getting at is that the way films were made in the Hollywood studio system, there was an auteur often, but it was the producer or it was like the studio. And so like they would move directors around, and it was almost like a work for hire type of situation. Mm-hmm. And so you look at something like The Wizard of Oz, there are like two or three different credited directors on that and Gone with the Wind. And at one point, the director of Wizard of Oz was moved to Gone with the Wind. And so like the black and white sequences were directed by a different person, the color sequences and such, et cetera, et cetera. And so starting in like 1948, there was an essay written by a guy named Alexandre Astruc. And it was called The Birth of the New Avant-Garde La Camera Stylo, which just means like camera pen. And he was just arguing that you could you could use the camera the same way an author would use a pen. Mm-hmm. And so even if there was a different screenwriter or someone doing an adaptation of a novel or something, the act of directing itself is a form of writing, which I think is true. I think like Orson Welles might push back on some of this because his idea was like editing is really like the thing, mm-hmm. Which is true, right? Like you really make the film in editing. So like what Alexander Ostrock wrote was, there's always an avant-garde when something new takes place. To come to the point, the cinema is quite simply becoming a means of expression, just as all the other arts have been before it, and in particular, painting the novel. After having been successfully a fairground attraction, an amusement analogous to boulevard theater, or a means of preserving the images of an era, it is gradually becoming a language. And by language, I mean a form in which and by which an artist can express his thoughts, however abstract they may be, or translate his obsession exactly as he does in the contemporary essay or novel. That is why I would like to call this new age of cinema the age of the camera stylo. Direction is no longer a means of illustrating or presenting a scene, but an act of writing. The filmmaking slash author writes with his camera as a writer writes with his pen, and an art which the length of the film and the soundtrack is put in motion and proceeds by means of a certain form and a certain story. And then so like this idea was then later taken up by Truffaut, and yeah, he detailed it in a series of essays, one of which is on a certain tendency of French film. And in that he sort of like goes at sort of the establishment of the French filmmakers and then talks about how the director can do more than just translate an adaptation. And I think the quote you were referring to is like, he talks about how Le Politique des Auteurs, but it says Le Politique des Auteurs. Films are of course made by a whole team of people, but either someone has something to say, or someone has a certain ideas about life or cinema or the world. So everything he does is interesting, even if some films are more so than others. Mm-hmm. Or it's someone who works anonymously and it's of little interest. Yeah. And it came from the phrase by, I guess it was a playwright named Girardot, who says there are no plays, only authors. And by that, he meant that there was a body of work and other plays or random successes or little interest. And so the idea is, the idea also had a meaning in French criticism in terms of French film, and it held that any film by Cocteau-Bresson was more interest, even if it wasn't ultimately a success, than a film by Jean Delanoë or any other director adapting a masterpiece anonymously, let's say. Yeah. And so like that gets picked up by an American critic named Andrew Saris, and he wrote a book where he sort of like interpreted that. And then he, in his book, he then like came up with some arbitrary categories. They're actually really strange to like name categories. And then he basically like puts all of Hollywood directors into these categories, basically like who's an auteur and who's not.
Wow.
And then after that, it goes into academia, right? And like, that's kind of like where because I didn't go to film school either, but like, that's kind of like where I lose track of where the idea develops further is like when it gets to academia. But I have seen like, there was a website, it was a database that was referred to as like the raw material of auteurism. And it had like a list of, it would list a director, their films, and all of their stylistic tendencies.
Wow.
Which I think is sort of like, to me, it seems almost like too mechanical a process at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, because it's not just camera tricks, you know, right. Or like not just stylistic tics, but it's like, someone's trying to really get at something and using the form to say something the same way a novelist would.
That is very interesting. Yeah. So that was the same quote that I watched the clip of, and he talks, yeah, he says, I thought that was an interesting part too, where he's like, any film by Bresson or any film by whoever, these like interesting auteurs, even a lesser one, is more interesting than, you know, whatever studio film. Mm-hmm. And you know, that to bring this to modern day a little bit, not to be controversial, but it reminded me of what Martin Scorsese said about Marvel a few years ago when he said, you know, that's not cinema. And, you know, thinking about, and I think that, you know, I don't want to bash Marvel. Obviously, you and I talked about Shang-Chi last year. Like, I like a lot of what they do. And I think they also have been intentionally, I think, like handing movies to like directors with a vision, like Chloe Zhao had her Marvel movie, all that. But generally, it's like, here's this It's almost like a TV show now where we have like a showrunner and Kevin Feige who's kind of pulling all the strings, but having maybe kind of like the old studio system, we'll plug in a director here, but we know what this is going to be, you know?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I think it makes sense to think of Kevin Feige as like a studio head from like the early 20th century.
It's almost like old Hollywood in a way. And so Martin Scorsese is saying those things are never going to be as interesting as what's the latest film from, you know, Steve McQueen or whoever that's like a director with a vision. I think that is really compelling, and I like that a lot. And I thought that was maybe a modern way to kind of think about this dichotomy.
Right. And I think like to some extent, like regardless of who you are, the idea of auteurism, it's sort of baked into everything. I think everybody kind of accepts it, even if you think you don't. Mm-hmm. Just because like it's how we talk about stuff, you know, like when you see when a new Spielberg film is coming out, it says from director Steven Spielberg or Robert Zemeckis gets name checked. Like the directors have become personalities in their own right. Mm-hmm. And even on stuff that like even on the studio films, I'm sure like that, like they march out Taika Waititi to talk about the new Thor, and like his personality is all over that movie.
There's
always been a tension too, right? Between the director and the producer, and there's always like battles. So like one of the people they lauded as an auteur is with Nicholas Ray, who did like Rebel Without a Cause. Mm-hmm. And one of his best films is Johnny Guitar. And the lead in that, I have to Google. I want to make sure. I'm going to say Shane Russell, but I want to make sure. But it might not be her. So you're going to have to cut this.
That's okay.
Joan Crawford. Yeah, so like in Johnny Guitar, like Joan Crawford was a producer in that film, and she had a lot of say in what happened. And you could argue that she was actually the auteur behind the film because she had so much influence in what got on camera.
That's making me think about like how Tom Cruise operates, right? Like he shows up in Top Gun and like he's not the director, but he's making a lot of the creative decisions because he has the pull of Tom Cruise, and like that to the detriment of some things, like whatever that Mummy reboot, I remember part of the problem supposedly was that like he wanted to change too much and it kind of fell apart. But anyway, or like the Mission Impossible stuff, like Steve McQuarrie is the director, but he's like their creative partners. And
I mean, they work really closely together. And I don't, listen to Q&A podcasts?
You send me the links and I'm like, oh, I'll listen to this. And then I have a couple of times.
So McQuarrie has been on there several times, and just like listening to their process is really interesting. Just because like with the Mission Impossible movies, it does seem like even if they have like a vague idea of what the plot is, it is really built around the set pieces, and it's really built around getting the studio to give them millions of dollars to travel the world, go to locations, and then figure out what the stunt is going to be, and then sort of reverse engineer the movie from that.
Wow.
And also like right on the fly, like you can change it at any time. And so I think this goes back to what I was saying last time we talked, which is the more you read, the more you learn that like what you think of as an unconventional process isn't that unconventional, because like Godard, I guess, famously worked in a similar fashion and just at a much lower scale, you know, not hundreds of millions of dollars. Like with like Viva Savi, I think they shot for a week, stopped production, then he figured out the movie, and then they started shooting again. Hmm. Or like Hong Sang-soo writes the scenes that they're going to shoot that day, the morning of. But like Truffaut worked in a similar fashion, it seemed like, like improvising dialogue with the actors sometimes on the day of. And just like being flexible.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And that's also probably very different from Hollywood studio system, when it was like, we're going to crank these movies out. We've got like all the people in place, and you know, that it's sort of a well-oiled machine, whereas this is a more free-flowing process. And then we talked about Wong Kar-wai being similar, as we talked about all his movies last year. Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, that's maybe a good transition to talking about Francois Truffaut. So last time we kind of focused on Godard, we talked about Truffaut a little bit, but I guess to kind of recap, what is kind of his place in the French New Wave? And we've kind of already touched on it with Cahiers du Cinéma and all of that, but what do you know about him and his, you know, his, whether that's his life or his kind of his work output.
To me, it seems like he was like one of the primary drivers of the movement, just in terms of the essays that he wrote for Cahiers du Cinéma, his fanatical cinemaphilia. Like he was really an advocate for cinema, and I think that his energy, not to go back to auteur theory, but like there was another essay in Cahiers du Cinéma where the author of this particular essay was just saying that like there was not unanimous consent on this, like they didn't have, like, everybody was on board, but his enthusiasm, I think, like Truffaut's enthusiasm in particular, is what sort of like drove the early movement.
Yeah, and you said last week too that it was like, you know, he has all these ideas, he's writing these essays, and then you know, he's sort of seen as this outsider, and then he gets funding to make the 400 Blows and like wins Cannes that year, right? And suddenly is like this huge name, and it's a little bit of sense of I have these ideas, okay, now prove it, and like it worked, you did it. And watching the 400 Blows this week and Jules and Jim, I had a little bit more of a sense of like the French New Wave. There's almost this like rock star energy, like being kind of rebellious and just like saying, "Oh, to hell with tradition," in a way, and like we're going to do things our own way, and here's how it turned out, kind of thing. So I don't know if that all tracks, but that's sort of the sense I had this week.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like, again, like they were trying to develop a language, right? Like they were trying to like figure out how you can convey ideas and emotions with the camera in a way that hadn't been done before. Or at least probably hadn't been done. This is like a whole other conversation, but sort of like the silent era and how many of those films don't exist and how like we may never know what we lost. But
yeah. Well, that's really interesting. Do you have thoughts generally about looking at Truffaut's actual style on camera versus maybe Godard or versus other people? Is there anything that's like, okay, this is what Truffaut did that was maybe his own thing that we can maybe pull from the movie?
Yeah, I don't know. I think they were equally playful in different ways. You know, like when we talk about, I think it was in 400 Blows, there's a shot where there's like a whip pan that cuts to another whip pan that ends up like being a close up, right? Like that's how like they get to the close up, and like that's really interesting. And then in Jules and Jim, there's just like so much energy in the movement of the camera, some freeze frame stuff.
Yeah,
and then also like in both films, he has a lot of like mixing in of like archival footage, but I think Godard's probably not above that either. I think where Godard's style goes seems much more essayistic, right? Like much more of like, especially in the late 60s when he becomes more political. Like I ended up watching after we recorded last time, I ended up watching Two or Three Things I Know About Her, which was another film about prostitution. But
that's Godard as well, right?
Yeah, that's Godard, but it was much less narratively driven. In fact, the narrative is almost completely separated from this essay that Godard sort of whisper reads throughout the film. And they're related thematically. But the essay doesn't necessarily drive the plot. And I think like, so Godard goes in a much different direction, sort of exploring what all you can do in different ways.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, there was that one sequence in Vivre sa vie that was sort of like that. Like we talked about, it's almost like learn about prostitution and how it's changed over the years. Like this little documentary. Of course, the whole thing is kind of a documentary style. But yeah, that's interesting. I've heard of two or three things that I've heard about her, I know about her, but I haven't seen it. But yeah, having seen, you know, two films by each director, I can't really speak to it. But there is something about Truffaut's films that I connect with a little bit easier. I don't know if it's like there's more of an emotional core.
Yeah, I think he's
like
warmer.
Yeah, I think that maybe that's right. Whereas, yeah, like, so I've seen Breathless and I've seen Vivre Sa Vie, and there's almost an academic quality to Vivre Sa Vie. It feels like, I guess, kind of what we're talking about, where it's like, here's an interesting thing to learn about. And then it makes sense that you're talking about, he kind of pushes that and becomes more, yeah, essayistic or whatever there. Whereas these two films by Truffaut that I've seen now, 400 Blows and Jules and Jim, yeah, I think warmer is a good way to say it. I felt more of an emotional connection, like, immediately with both of them than I did with Vivre Sa Vie, which is not necessarily good or bad. But I think the last time I was like, yeah, I don't know, I didn't fully connect with Vivre Sa Vie, but I really liked Jules and Jim a lot, and The 400 Blows as well.
Yeah, so, I think Truffaut just does a really good job of thinking of the characters as people. And I think, I mean, and I don't want to project onto anybody, but it just seems like Truffaut in general probably cares about people more.
yeah I can, that feels right to me, but yeah, maybe we don't want to bash Godard. What a bastard that guy was. Just kidding. But yeah, so I guess let's talk about Truffaut's films and Jules and Jim. How many of his films have you seen? I've just told you I've seen now two, so you've probably seen more than I have.
Yeah, let me pull up Letterboxd real quick, because I know I've seen, although, what? Go ahead.
I was going to say, although I realized, I think he directed Fahrenheit 451 for the 60s version of that, which I have seen. It's been a very long time, and I certainly didn't, like, know who Truffaut was when I watched it. So there's a third, technically, that I remember very little about, but I love that book.
I mean, while I'm looking, I know... Similarly to Godard, I would say I haven't seen like a ton. Mm-hmm. I've definitely, like, 400 Blows, Jules and Jim, Day for Night. Mm-hmm. According to Letterboxd, I've seen five. I forgot, I was watching something and he was talking about one of his less successful films, and he referenced The Bride Wore Black. And I was like, oh yeah, I forgot that he made that film, which is like, it's like his Hitchcock film. And I think it's interesting because, like, I don't think anybody was really able to make a Hitchcock film except Hitchcock until Brian De Palma. And he does it, and, like, De Palma does it by, like, also putting his own lurid spin on things. Mm-hmm. And, like, because by the time De Palma's making films, you can be much more explicit and provocative than you could. According to Letterboxd, I've seen five.
There you go. Would you say, like, Jules and Jim is one of your favorites of those five?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Although there's one, Shoot the Piano Player, which I would like to watch again because I love that title.
Yeah.
And I don't remember anything about it.
I think that the progression time-wise was 400 Blows and then Shoot the Piano Player and then this, I think. And maybe let me see if there's anything else in between there. But I'm pretty sure that's the order of things. And, you know, I think the way I become familiar with titles is, like, looking at the Criterion stuff, and so all three of those are on Criterion, but he has a ton that are not. And he also acted too. I'm seeing, like,
he's in Close Encounters. 400 Blows.
Oh, he's in 400 Blows. I saw
there's a little cameo
of that. But let's see. Yeah, so 400 Blows is 59, Shoot the Piano Player in 60, Jules and Jim in 62, Fahrenheit 451 in 66. I've heard of Stolen Kisses in 68, Bed and Board in 70, Day for Night is 73. And then The Last Metro, I've seen the cover on that. That's 1980. And then it looks like his very last is Confidentially Yours in 1983. So, yeah. Interesting run. And so today we're going to talk about Jules and Jim. Although, for Patreon listeners, you will also, the bonus episode that you will get is also us talking about 400 Blows. So I'll tease that here. We're going to talk about that one as well in more depth for the patrons only feed. But yeah, so let's talk about Jules and Jim. Maybe let's start talking about the performers. So obviously we have Jules and Jim, the two title characters are Oscar Werner and Henri Serre. Again, French pronunciations I'm probably getting wrong. But then also Jeanne Moreau is Catherine, or Katrina. The French is different than what they put in the subtitles, but she's really the central focus of the story. I guess we can start with one of them, but, like, are these performers, you know, people that were significant outside of this film? Did they continue to work in the French New Wave or elsewhere?
You know, John Moreau is definitely significant. I'm seeing she died in 2017, so like relatively recently.
Yeah.
Like she was in Orson Welles' The Trial. She was in, let's see.
I know she's I'm looking a few, for something a few I recognize. Other things that are kind of quintessentially fringe new wave, and I'm gonna look back and see what those were. Wow, she has a ton of credits on IMDb. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, she's got a credit. She's in Love Actually.
Oh yeah.
Uncredited. Actually. Yeah, I don't know. It's like a very, very, very small role. Yeah.
That's funny.
She's
in The 400 Blows, actually. That's interesting. But then, yeah, I know she's in like A Woman Is a Woman. That's a significant one as well. See, I'm looking at these other titles.
Last Tycoon.
Okay, yeah.
It's an Elia Kazan film, which was adapted from an unfinished F. Scott Fitzgerald novella.
Wow. Yeah, she's incredible in this film. Like, so amazing. I found a quote. So I read, there's an article on Criterion's website. I think it's probably like one of the articles that comes in the Criterion edition of Jules and Jim, but it's on Jules and Jim by John Powers, who actually that name you might recognize because he wrote all the stuff in the Wong Kar Wai set and that Wong Kar Wai book that I think you and I both purchased a copy of. He wrote that as well. So we've talked about him before, but he wrote this essay. And then here's just a quote about her and her character, Catherine. It says, on paper, the mercurial Catherine seems an implausibly grandiose conception, a woman both giddy and tragic, proto-feminist and male-dominated, driven by Eros and Thanatos. But as played by Moreau, a pop-eyed siren with the ferocity of Betty Davis and the kitty cat wiles of Tuesday Weld, Catherine becomes one of the modern movie's triumphant characterizations, the enema as autocrat. So I like his writing style for one thing, but yeah, I think that's true because she seems contradictory, in that she, like, there's the scene where they've been to a play and Jules is spewing a bunch of misogynistic stuff about what he basically like was inspired by the play. And he's saying all these things about women are like this. And, you know, they have to, and like, I think he says the woman's fidelity is the most important part of any relationship. Like, oh my God. And then she jumps in the river, right? Which is a great moment. And so she is in a way this sort of, you know, rebellious feminist person. But then at the same time, she is so tied to the men in her life. And so like that seems contradictory in a way, but I think, yeah, the performance grounds it in such a way that the character really works. The performance is so, so amazing. Yeah, so this is, I think, my first time really noticing her. So apparently I've seen her in a few other things, but I thought she was incredible in this.
Yeah, and I think as a character, like, I feel like I've known a couple of people who are like this, right? Who just, like, are such, like, powerful personalities and command attention. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, I remember, like, the first time I saw this film, I thought that a good alternate title would just be, like, ... and Catherine. You know, yeah. And just because like she really is like the focus, and like every time anyone gets comfortable, she like has this way of disrupting what's happening. Right. Just like the moment you were talking about where like they're having this conversation. She's not really a part of it. And she's like, this is not what we're doing. I'm going to jump in the river. And she just commands, she just directs the situation to what she wants. And there's no. And she's selfish and she's okay with that. And she has a worldview, that is sort of odd. Like, cause they talk a lot about when she has to like even the score.
Yeah.
What even does that even really mean? Yeah. But like, she has a way of like just making it like forcing you to be okay with whatever she wants.
Yeah. 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 I think that's very true. And like she holds a lot of sway in a way over the men in her life, but at the same time, she seems to really be dependent on them as well. It's really interesting. I think so. Okay, I guess maybe we're jumping into just talking about the film itself, but I was so fascinated by this just because of those relationship dynamics and like the gender dynamics of it all. I thought were really interesting. And it's like, I say this all the time when I watch a classic movie, but I'm like, oh, I can't believe these things were on people's mind this many years ago. Cause it feels modern in a way, kind of the relationship dynamics of it. I mean, I'm sure that people who are polyamorous probably really like this movie, and like there's a lot to kind of chew on with that sort of thing too. And I didn't know that was an aspect of the story at all, actually going into it.
It's adapted from a book. It's semi-autobiographical, but yeah, I mean, it's adapted from a book that was like, is about the relationship with this author and a friend of his and his friend's wife. And so like, yes, not only was this depicted in media, but this was like actually happening, you know, I guess to some extent, and probably going back several thousand years, you know, or to like the dawn of man. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it is just like in American media, we're just very squeamish about things, and there's certain things we just don't talk about.
Yeah, it feels pretty transgressive by like, you know, modern American standards. But it also, like, I always wonder, like, is that how it struck the audience at the time in France in that time? Like, was this like, you know, did it feel revolutionary in the way that it kind of did to me watching it the other night? Like, yeah, maybe there's not an answer to that that's easily discernible, at least for this conversation. But I am curious about, like, how did audiences react to this? Obviously, it was a very successful movie. There's some essay I read by Martin Scorsese. I can't remember. He's talking about, like, being alive at this time and, like, all the art house cinemas. You could go down the block to this and see Jules and Jim. We can go over here and see this. And I'm trying to remember where that was. I'll try to find it and link to it. But it was really fascinating. It kind of put me in the mindset of like a cinema fan at this time. That's kind of a tangent, but I am curious like how audiences felt about this film.
Yeah. I think Truffaut made another film. I can't remember the name of it, but he references in an interview where it's the same situation, but reversed. Sorry. So there's two women, one man,
Two English Lovers, I think is the name.
Yeah. And it just didn't do as well. And I guess, you know, there are certain aspects of this that I think people maybe are more comfortable with than others. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the film's not good. Maybe that's why it didn't do well. I don't know.
Yeah. You mean it's reversed like in terms of it's two women and one man?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
And I think it's also adapted from a work by the same author.
Well, I'm going to look and see really quickly to make sure I had the title of that film right. Because one of the essays I looked at, I didn't read the whole thing, but it's also on Criterion's website. And it is about that film. And it basically said that, like, Jules and Jim, Truffaut is young and kind of carefree in a way and makes this really energetic film about this love triangle, Jules and Jim. And later in his career, once he's, he was in his 30s or not even 30 yet when he made Jules and Jim. And then later in his career, he made Two English Girls.
Yes. Yeah.
And
which is a...
It's sort of a more, according to this essay, is a, like a more mature look at this kind of situation, and he seems a little more jaded with life or something like that. So I could also see how that might sell a little less better than this kind of fun. And it's so funny. I was thinking about like when I tell my wife about the movies I'm watching, I give her like, you know, a one sentence. And it's like, I watched The 400 Blows. Really interesting and also terribly sad. And then I watched Jules and Jim, this kind of fun and sexy movie, and then terribly sad in the end. And then Viva Sa Vie, interesting, and then really sad. Like all these movies are kind of sad. But yeah, with Jules and Jim, I think there's such an energy, and it's so fun for a lot of it. And then it settles into this kind of melancholy, almost melodrama kind of feeling at the end. It's like, what's she gonna do next is kind of how I felt at the end of this movie. And then I almost not predicted the ending, but I was like, I mean, this is gonna escalate to some degree. Yeah. To what it does, and that's kind of what happens. I did really like this movie. I forgot what I was talking about at this point.
Two English Girls. Yes, which actually girls. So it's also like the two women are not friends, they're sisters.
Ah, interesting.
So that's, yeah.
Well, is there anything, I guess, so you texted me about the style of this movie the other day when you went, or today earlier, and I immediately first thought, oh, he's probably talking about the filmmaking style, but he also could be talking about the fashion, because that's something that I really liked, was the clothing. But yeah, were you talking about like the actual...
I was talking about the filmmaking. One, it's like this movie, like that pace to me is amazing, right? Like it really, like it starts and it moves and it's subtitled. But they're like fast subtitles, so you kind of either have to like read them fast or just like accept that you're not going to catch every single word. But then, like, there are these different stylistic elements, like there's this scene where Therese, I think, is the character's name.
Yeah.
And she's just like, what's that, like a steam engine?
Yeah, she blows out of her cigarette like she looks like a train. Yeah.
Right. And then, like, the camera just tracks her face as she does, like, a full circle around the room and then comes back to Jules. And just the energy in that shot, like, it's so alive and vibrant. Yeah. And then, like, later, there's the scene where Catherine is saying, like, you know, before I used to be sad. And there were, like, these freeze frames, you know, like, it'll just freeze on different expressions. And I was just like, that is such an interesting touch. And I was reading that, like, Scorsese referenced this film for Goodfellas, like, in terms of.
I read
like,
that too. I was going to bring that up. Go ahead.
Like just like the voiceover narrative and just like some of those freeze frame elements and things like that. Like, he was trying to channel this energy. And like that, Goodfellas is another movie that just like is constantly moving.
Yeah.
Right. But in a way where, and I'm not trying to like just like slag on stuff, but like there's a good way to like keep your film, like the pace of your film going. And then there's like a bad way. And I think a way that's not really successful is like The Force Awakens.
Okay.
Where it's just like the plot, it's just always sort of like moving forward before you have time to process anything. Mm-hmm. But like, it seems like it's in a way to keep you from thinking about what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. Whereas like there's an intentionality to the pace and the energy in Jules and Jim and in Goodfellas and like films like that, where it's like this, it's about making you feel a certain way, not to hide like a lack of a story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, I read that about Goodfellas as well, and specifically like the opening of Goodfellas has, you know, this long narrator and voiceover, and so does this. And that was, so this movie just opens with like this bombastic, like, I think trumpets or some kind of brass, and this loud music, and then really fast, like, it was almost overwhelming. I can imagine like being in a cinema and then that comes on the screen and just like mind blown, you know. And it is so quick for the first like 2 or 3 minutes of explaining things in this narration, and the camera's moving all over the place. Whereas like 400 Blows, which I also watched, has also a really great opening, but it's like this kind of a little slower, and we're seeing all these shots of the Eiffel Tower, and it's kind of drawing it, both really good introductions. But yeah, I liked the beginning of this film a lot as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so, it's like alive, you know, like it just makes you excited to want to like keep watching it in a way that I think a lot of films can't do. Mm-hmm. It's sort of depressing actually, because when you think about a lot of films now, and it's like, just like the creativity of what they were doing in the late 50s and the 60s, and like a lack of creativity from like large productions now.
And it's, I mean, I always come back to art and commerce. I probably think too much about capitalism, but I think that's probably a lot of the reason is, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, like with the amount of money involved in films now, they're just much more conservative in what they do, because there's a lot of money involved.
Gotta please everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And also on the energy aspect of it, when they race across the bridge, I love that scene as well. And they, first of all, she like dresses in drag, basically. He's like, "I'll see if I can fool someone. They think I'm a man," which is such a funny thing. And then, there's a close up, like a kind of side profile as she's running. And then just like, the energy of that. And then there's a few kind of sequences later in the film where they're kind of running together, like through early in the film when they're young and carefree and they're running through this park. And then later it's kind of recalled when they have Sabine there, the daughter, and that like that, you always ask me, did you cry when I watch a movie? That was the moment that I got really emotional, was like after all these years and World War One has happened, they've been separated, now they're back and they kind of fall into it. And then of course that's kind of shattered in the next few scenes and everything kind of falls apart again. Yeah. But like having that friendship and the relationship back again, and now with this new added element of their daughter. But also on the freeze frame thing, I love that touch too early in the film. And then it comes back just one moment when they are reunited, Jules and Jim, and they like shake hands and it freeze frames and it's like they're back. Yeah, really just so creative formally. That I think was the most exciting thing for me about this movie. I have to mention too, Sabine is the cutest kid ever. she's like such big round cheeks, and she says at one point, she's au revoir, Jim, and it's just thinking cute. So I always loved when Sabine was there. But Oh, I also loved this. So there's parts of, I'm just looking through my notes on the film, but they have this long discussion, almost like in Viva Sa Vie, where, you know, she sits down and talks to this philosopher, mm-hmm. and then what they read a portion of something about Edgar Allan Poe, it's like it bringing in those other things. It happens maybe a little more organically in this, which maybe that's also an interesting like counterpoint with Godard. Is he's becoming more like academic almost and bringing all these things in, whereas this felt like more of the narrative and the warmer idea. But they talk about the genders of words, and because he Jules is German, and then Jim is French, and so they like what words have different genders and which ones don't have a gender, which is such an interesting thing. As you know, as a student of English, we don't really have that equivalent in English, and so I thought that was fascinating as well. Another, I'm just kind of like laundry listing things I liked about the movie, but when there's the World War One sequence, which is longer than I expected, and we get that archival footage you mentioned, and we have like their letters back and forth, like to their lovers. And I was so moved also by they each, because they end up fighting on opposite sides of the war. They're called back. He's called back to Germany to fight. They both have a line about, I worry every day that I'm going to kill Jim. I worry every day that I'm going to kill Jules. That was so moving. That was really, really well done as well. But
yeah. You know, I usually, there's something about like a lot of World War One movies that don't work for me. Because, and I mean, I guess, I mean, I wasn't there, but when you read about like World War One and trench warfare, it's just so horrific that I don't know how you can romanticize it, except that it gets romanticized in the, like, as like a counterpoint to like World War Two a lot of times. Mm-hmm. So like, and I think, I guess also like part of it is like, was just with World War One, there's a sense of like, what is this even about? Like, why is this even happening? But like, this is one of the few World War One movies where it works, you know, just like the idea, like the depiction of it works for me here.
Yeah.
Another one would be like The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, I guess, which is, it's kind of weird. It's a movie by Powell and Pressburger, who did The Red Shoes, but it's kind of romanticizes the war a little bit, but I think similarly, it sort of ends at the eve of World War II, which sort of explains why you might romanticize some aspects of something like that. I'm actually not sure when Jules and Jim ends.
Yeah, it's a little vague. Like, and even like at first I was like, oh, this must be World War I, but I wasn't clear on that at the beginning either. Like I wasn't sure what the time frame was.
But I think there's like a reference towards the end that sounded like maybe they're in the 30s. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know either. But yeah, I thought the inclusion of the war stuff was well done. And yeah, I mean, just generally, this movie covered a lot more time than I expected as well. You know, by the end of the movie, it's been, I don't know, a very long time. Like, it's been maybe a decade or longer. I mean, must be more than a decade because they have this child and everything. Just looking at a friendship over that much time, like, I think that's what's cool too, is like the relationship between Jules and Jim is really well established and is even an important part of the story going forward, apart from Catherine. And then of course she's a part of it as well. But like I think some of the most significant parts of the film too, for me, are when, so Jim has this attraction to Catherine and like, we know it and he kind of knows it and he's kind of like trying not to. But then when Jules has the heart to heart and says,
not this one.
Yeah. He said at the beginning, he says, not this one. But then much later in the film, when it's like, okay, this is probably going to happen, that's where he says, like, he basically gives his blessings, like, don't let me be an obstacle here, even though they are married. And yeah, that, and the fact that that was shocking, but at the same time, like, I believed that he would do that because these are such good friends, like, the kind of person that Jules is. Like, there's such a good, a sense of character for each of the people involved. And sometimes, I don't know, in movies, it's like, okay, there's just two men and they're kind of like guys, but like they each have their own distinct worldviews. And like, we just really get a good sense of each of them. And then that ends up, of course, playing into how everything happens in the last third or so.
They're good friends, but it's also just like, a lot of it seems like it's just, this is the only way Jules knows how to ensure that Catherine will stay in his life.
Right.
And like also the other threat is that the other guy that she's seeing is saying, like, you come with me and bring your daughter. And so Jules is also trying to hang on to his daughter as well.
Yeah, I think it's on the surface, it seems like Jules must just let everyone walk all over him. And that's not exactly the case. You know, it's not that simple. And I think that the performance does a good job of, like, showing that he, he loves her. And it's a way to, I think there's also a brief moment where Catherine and Jim are talking when they've just kind of taken up together. And they're, like, walking in the woods. And there's a moment where she says something like, we'll both respect him and he respects both of us, and like, this will work, you know? Mm. And it's just, yeah, that dynamic is so unusual. But
Jim also makes a reference to his to Jules' Buddhist philosophy at one point.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. And it's just like, okay, yeah, like, maybe this is something he's done some work on himself.
Yeah.
to get to this point.
He's cool with this. Yeah. And then Albert's the other side of that. Yeah. Wow. Well,
but then the narrator tells us that when at one point when Catherine starts flirting with Jules again, Jim gets jealous.
Yes. Yeah. It's an interesting moment too. And he hears them upstairs, like, cavorting or whatever. And there's just like a brief moment, and then it's like things kind of go back to normal. Yeah. So it's not as simple that they're like, I don't know, to put it in like modern terms, which, you know, they didn't have back then. It's not as quite as simple as they're like a triad or they're poly or whatever. There's the lines aren't always clear cut, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think there's not always communication about defining how this all works. They're just kind of living together. Yeah. Interesting. Well, is there anything else that you have learned about this film in your research that you want to bring into this discussion?
I would say the one thing, I think I would like to see it again to see how much this is true, but like the music really holds everything together. It's so romantic.
Oh yeah, you mentioned
but that also sort of melancholy. And it was composed by a guy named Georges Delarue. Mm-hmm. And like, I think like it's on like Time's list of like top 100 film scores of all time, which I think it deserves to be on there. And it's just like, there's something like it's so perfectly matched for the tone of this film, right? Because it is sort of like melancholy, and like it's not like if you're just like kind of casually listening, it kind of sounds upbeat, but it really isn't, and it's it directs you to where the film is going.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an element that I definitely noticed. Oh, this music is nice, but I didn't key into it that closely. That's what I'll watch for on a rewatch, is paying closer attention to that score. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I didn't really look into like the production really of the film. So I don't know if there are any interesting stories about like how the film was made.
Yeah, I don't either. We can cut this part then. But yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. And yeah, the energy of it, it kind of transforms into this melancholy place at the end. It almost, far be it for me to criticize a masterpiece from, you know, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, but it got to be at the end a little bit like, okay, I'm ready for it. The story becomes, what's Catherine going to do next to cause trouble? And it became a little bit, not repetitive, but just a little, I don't know. I also don't want to say it was hard to get through because I was invested, but I think it maybe dragged a little or something. And it kind of, I guess it needed time to build to that ending, which again, so tragic. And like the final shot is him just walking away from the
crematorium muscle. Or I guess is he in the cemetery? He's put their ashes in a vault.
Yeah. Just walk away. And then it's Fiend. And,
I mean, things escalate kind of quickly, right? Catherine is spurned, right? Because Jim decides to go back to Gertrude, but it starts with a G.
Yeah, it's funny because it almost sounds like a masculine name to my, you know, modern American ears.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what it is though as well. I'll look really quickly. Oh my gosh, I lost my tab again too. The character's name is Gilbert. It looks like Gilbert with an E at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. So like when Jim decides to go back to her, Catherine just feels like a spurned woman. And so she starts to act out erratically, more so than usual, I guess. First she goes back, what's his name? Arthur?
Albert.
Albert. Yeah, Albert, yeah. Right. So like, yeah. And she makes a point of making sure they know what she's doing. Because she's like, come get in my car and we're going. She happens to meet up with Albert and happens to stay with them. And then they have to like walk back.
That's so interesting. So there's also that sequence where like Jim finally leaves when they can't conceive, and then she tells him that she has, but it's never confirmed or denied. Is your read on that she really was pregnant and then lost
the baby? I don't know.
That was fabricated. I think he accuses her of lying, but it's never.
Yeah.
I never see her, you know, pregnant belly or anything.
They also make a big deal of like them sort of waiting to try until slept with Albert.
Yeah.
And so she has to like wait and make sure that if she gets pregnant, it's not going to be Albert's. And there's just something that's toxic.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like torn.
Yeah.
And it's weird because like as a viewer, I don't want to have any judgment, right? But it, like the whole situation is just not a good situation. It's not healthy at all, actually. Yeah. Even though like they try, like Jules tries to make it work, but like it's just not.
Yeah, and I thought it was going to get to a place that maybe they're going to pull this off, and that's going to be like the wild ending is that this works, but no.
And then Catherine pulls a gun on Jim.
Oh yeah, that scene. So that happened. I was like, I thought she might kill him, and then she doesn't kill him then, but later. She does.
There was a sly reference to her buying a gun and Jim and Jules thinking that she was going to hurt herself.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, there's the gun, and she's going to hurt somebody else. And then,
Yes. Wow. Quite is a there film, like a Jules and Jim?
Yeah, I wonder if it's sort of like a good feminist writer who's taken on that character, like really written a good essay. Is what I should actually.
Yeah, read. I would love to read that too. So because there's a line early on that. It's when he says, Jules is asking Jim, you think I should marry her? And Jim says, you know, maybe she's not meant for one man. Maybe she says something like, or I think I wrote it down. It's very male gazey what he says. She's a vision for all, perhaps not meant to be loved by any one man. And so, yeah, there is that aspect of it that at times feels a bit misogynistic. I mean, obviously that sounds very misogynistic, but again, the character has so much depth that it's not quite that simple. So yeah, I would love to read a feminist writer talking about this. It's a good call. Well, any other thoughts on Jules and Jim before we wrap up this episode?
I love it. Maybe I'll screen it sometime. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be a good one for the big screen. Absolutely. Yeah, it's on Criterion Channel. There's a ton of Criterion extras with it that I did not have time to get to. There's like two commentaries, I think, and a bunch of other stuff. So check all of that out. Stream it there. It's also streaming on HBO Max. All right. Well, I think we can wrap up our Jules and Jim talk. Let's talk about what we're going to do next time as we move to the Left Bank. So I guess first we're going to talk about what is the Left Bank. So we'll get into that. So is that just briefly, is that like sort of a subset or just like another group of filmmakers kind of tied into French New Wave, but their own thing? How would you describe that?
I would describe them as a group of filmmakers that were a little older than the Cahiers du Cinéma bunch and were probably more politically defined from the outset. And I think they grapple with politics in their films from the beginning, whereas with the Cahiers du Cinéma crowd, we can actually really talk about sort of like how the different approaches to politics in film and whether or not politics should be subservient to story or whether or not a film should stand in its own right.
Yeah,
but that's like some of the stuff that we're going to have to get into when we talk about the difference between Cahiers du Cinéma Group and the Left Bank.
And so yeah, we'll talk about that. And then we're also going to talk about One Sings, the Other Doesn't. That's a film from Agnes Varda. Excited to pull my Varda box set down and pop another one of those discs in. And that's one that I as I understand, is pretty political in nature. I think I heard a podcast talk about it, you know, a few years ago, and I barely remember anything. But so I'm excited to watch it. And to talk a little bit about Varda and her place in all of this. And then we're also going to talk about La Jetée, the greatest short film of all time, according
That's
to
right.
Omaya. All right. So that's for next time. One Thing's the Other Doesn't, I believe, is also streaming on HBO Max. Let me just verify that quickly if you want to watch that to kind of get caught up. One Thing's the Other Doesn't from 1977. Yes, it's on HBO Max and Criterion Channel. I forgot to check about La Jetée. Let me look really quick.
Apparently you can rent it from Apple TV, Amazon, or actually, you know what? It's also on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm seeing it's on YouTube.
Because I've sent it to people.
It's 28 minutes long here, so I can even link to that. Some of these older films, like the copyrights are messy, and so I don't think it's a terrible thing to share the YouTube link. So I'll link that in the show notes as well. All right, cool. So that's for next time. And from there, we can wrap up. And so, yeah, that the plan is for that to be 2 weeks from this episode. So we will talk to you next time. Thanks so much, Omaya.
Thank you.
Huge thanks to Omaya. I can't wait to continue on in this series with him. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, and that is hugely helpful. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.